Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn. Canadian John Valiant is the author of The Tiger, a true story of vengeance and survival. It is the stuff of adventure movies, but it goes much deeper. Valiant explains the true story behind the book.
In 1997, the Russian economy had collapsed during the 1990s. You know, communism went away, and you know, we all thought that was wonderful, but it was very destructive to Russians because nothing filled the gap. So in the Russian Far East, in Primorsky Krai, where this story takes place, mostly loggers and miners and people like that, it's all, you know, resource extraction. Those industries collapsed, and these people were simply abandoned in the forest, literally abandoned. So they had to go hunting. There was no, they had families. And this one fellow, Vladimir Markov, was a heavy equipment operator for a logging company. No more work, no more opportunity, and so he went hunting. And that was illegal too, but he had to do it to feed his family. And the tragedy was that there were tigers living in his area. The Chinese border was 50 miles away. The money that represented by a dead tiger in terms of its value on the Chinese market was irresistible to him. And he shot this tiger and wounded it. And the tiger identified him and hunted him, followed him back to his cabin, killed his dogs, started systematically destroying his belongings, and waited for him. And this man was a hunter. This was his cabin. This was his place. He left seeking the kind of the counsel and advice of some other hunters and trappers in the area. But eventually he had to come back, partly because his dogs, he knew that's where his dogs were going to go. And they were his hunting dogs. His livelihood depended on them. But also because that was his home. And, you know, he was a Russian. He wasn't an indigenous guy. He wasn't a native guy for whom the tigers are deities. He was a Russian guy. And a Russian guy isn't going to let a tiger run him off his property. So he went back, he was armed, he was ready, but the tiger was readier. The tiger was waiting by his front door and attacked him head on. Wasn't hiding, was sitting in the open, essentially with its arms crossed, waiting for him to come back. It was like a hit. And he killed this man and ate him. And that set a whole nother series of events because the tiger then killed another hunter, another armed man who was a poacher, who knew there was a dangerous tiger out there, but Hunt killed him in the same way, confrontationally, coming at him from the open, not hiding. And despite the fact that both these men were armed, former soldiers, skilled hunters, they could not stop this animal.
Producer Constance Crompton interviewed Valiant in October when he was in Salt Lake City as a guest of the University of Utah Creative Writing Program.
The Amur tiger is a subspecies popularly called the Siberian tiger, and it lives, in fact, beyond Siberia, nearly 5,000 miles from Moscow, in the remote realm of far eastern Russia. It is named after the Amur River, the third longest river in Asia and the longest undammed river in the world, located in an ecological paradise unique on Earth. It hosts the greatest biodiversity of any place in Russia and is the home of rare butterflies and an unclassifiable species of raccoon dog. This is the kingdom in which the Amur tiger reigns.
The Amur tiger is an amazing animal. It's generally believed to be the largest cat living today. They can grow over 10 feet long. They can weigh over 600 pounds. But they can also jump across a residential street. They can jump over a basketball hoop. They have this amazing combination of mass, kind of horse-sized mass, with this incredible grace and agility. I wouldn't say they're great runners. They're ambush hunters like all cats. And so they're very good in the short run, and they're incredibly powerful. So they have an almost kind of bear-like upper body strength, if you will. Very powerful shoulders, very powerful forepaws. And What you'll also notice about them, and this is really what distinguishes them from all other subspecies, is their incredibly lustrous and dense coat. So it's almost like, to get a visual on an Amur tiger, it's almost better to imagine a lynx, you know, that incredible brushy, bushy fur. And then imagine a lynx that weighs 500 pounds, and you're getting close to the visual impact of the Amur tiger. And they can survive, as no other tigers can, in Arctic conditions. The temperature in the Russian Far East can drop to minus 40, minus 50 degrees below zero, and they don't hibernate. They're out in the elements all the time. They often, males particularly, hunt alone, so it's not like they can curl up with another tiger when it's cold. Of course, the cubs will do that with their mother, but a lone female, a lone male are completely out there, and they have to be these kind of perfectly self-contained units, surviving under really extraordinary circumstances.
There's a theme that runs through your work. You explore what happens when human ambition and power collide, and I like that word, collide, with the natural world.
The tiger is a story of collisions, really almost at every level, and that's really what drew me to it. The environment is a place of collision in terms of, it's the only place on Earth where species of the boreal, like timber wolves and wolverines and reindeer, overlap with species of the subtropics, like leopards, tigers, exotic birds, and butterflies. At the cultural level, this unique zone, this unique ecosystem, lies right on the Russian-Chinese border. The Russian-Chinese border has always been contentious. And now there's an enormous amount of anxiety, especially on the Russian side, as China is so much in the ascendant now. There are Russians who are genuinely afraid of being overrun. On the environmental level, what you see on the Russian side of the border is so starkly different from what now remains on the Chinese side. They're, of course, the same ecosystem, separated only by a border. But on the Chinese side, everything has been scraped away. There are virtually no trees left. There are virtually no animals left. It's all been converted into arable land, which is seriously compromised now by overuse. You cross over into onto the Russian side of the border, and all of a sudden, the land is much healthier. And that in itself is a contradiction. We think of Russia generally as a kind of environmental disaster zone. And in fact, the Russian Far East, this small region of it, Primorsky Krai, also known as Primorya, is this last redoubt for the Siberian tiger, which I also call the Amur tiger. For tiger species around the world, I would say the Amur tiger has one of the best chances of any of the surviving subspecies.
Now, the parallels between Homo sapiens and tigers. At one point, you say they evolved to coexist.
The species Homo sapiens, we, are roughly the same age as tigers. And we evolved in Asia side by side. So the tiger is believed to have evolved in China and then disseminated itself across Asia. So for Asian Homo sapiens, there's really no corner of their consciousness, no corner of their history that doesn't have tigers in it somewhere. So tigers have been informing the Asian consciousness effectively forever. And it's one reason they are, you know, considered sacred animals there. It's one reason they are so iconic there. And it's also one reason they are still consumed by many Asians. The tigers are poached and broken down into their component parts because of the magical, powerful properties that tigers are still believed to possess. And people still want to be close to that energy. And think of all the sports teams that call themselves tigers. Think of the huge insurance companies or oil companies. And the power of that animal has really transcended its borders, has transcended, you know, race and class and language and ethnicity, and has been embraced worldwide in a way that really very few other animals have. And one thing that I was thinking about, what is a tiger? You know, what does it really represent? And the tiger simultaneously represents power, sex, and danger. And yet, what other such symbol would a parent allow their six-year-old daughter to have a picture of on their wall? The tiger also represents this very cuddly, beautiful, appealing kind of poster child for the conservation movement. I mean, the versatility of this animal and its universal appeal to humans is, I think it's unmatched by any other creature.
There's something that you pointed out. There's a certain little pill that is aptly named.
Oh, yeah.
It's an interesting fact.
Yeah. One of the reasons Asians kill and break tigers down into various parts is for the tiger's aphrodisiac properties. So the genitalia of tigers are believed to enhance your sexual prowess. And the makers of Viagra seem to be aware of that. And Viagra, it translated into Sanskrit. It's a Sanskrit word originally, and it means tiger. And so just take one of these blue tiger pills, and you will be a tiger too. And it's the shame is that drug can't penetrate more deeply into Asian culture, because I think it would save a lot of tigers' lives.
Since 1993, it has been a violation of international law to sell tiger parts for any purpose. The Chinese government has taken steps to prevent tiger poaching, but there are a number of tiger farms, and it is estimated that there are at least 4,000 captive-bred tigers on these farms.
I mean, there are lots of Chinese who understand that tigers are endangered. In terms of traditional Chinese medicine, which historically has used tiger parts, respectable practitioners of traditional Chinese medicine no longer endorse the use of tiger parts. Still, there is this kind of underground, kind of folk market, and also the status symbol of the tiger skin, of the fangs, of the claws is still very attractive to some people. But there are commercial businessmen, private enterprises in China who have decided to breed tigers in the hopes that this law will be overturned or that somehow fate will turn their way and allow them to sell bred tigers. So there are about a dozen of these farms, you know, to call them farms is even that is kind of a misnomer, a dozen of these breeding complexes in China, and I visited one of these. And, you know, they're called breeding and rehabilitation centers, which is really window dressing. There's no rehabilitation going on. They're living in these tiny little pens, and then they are set out, you know, in these larger enclosures, you know, dozens of tigers all kind of mingling with each other, which is completely unnatural. Who knows what they're fed, honestly? It's not really clear what they're fed. And there's no way these animals could be returned to the wild because they have no competence for surviving in the wild for reasons I described earlier. And so it's a very cynical enterprise, and basically no one's quite sure what they do with the bodies. When they die, do they freeze them, or do they secretly distribute them into the market? And that's not clear. But when I was there, I went to one, and you could buy tiger wine and this giant glass vat of wine or something like wine with a tiger carcass in it, an entire skeleton with ligaments and flesh hanging off the bone. And you ladle this out, and it's about $100 a liter. And this, again, is, you know, the promise of drinking such a beverage is to give you an exciting time with your sweetheart. So, I mean, it's bizarre and crazy seeming and shocking. And at the same time, you have to, you know, realize that the tiger has been a power animal, for lack of a better word, for Asians for tens of thousands, if not millions of years. I mean, it's deeply embedded in the consciousness and the spirituality and at every level of their belief systems. And also there are Chinese who are working actively to protect tigers. So there's a real tension. There's a real tension. But there's no question that these tiger farms are, they really are crimes against nature.
Maybe you could discuss a bit that dilemma or the conflict with the poachers. Their economic plight and the ironies of that.
So in Russia, there wasn't a tradition, if you will, of man-eating the way there has been in India and parts of China historically. Because there were fewer people and in some ways and the tigers and prey were more dispersed because it's at a higher latitude, which generally is what happens, there were fewer conflicts. And the indigenous people who still live in Russia, in the Russian Far East, the Udigay, the Nanai, for them that the tiger was a god, you know, a land-based deity. And you don't kill your gods. You respect your gods. You stay out of their way. And even for the Russian Christian hunters who came to the Far East, they had this kind of live and let live attitude. And it was different for farmers because farmers didn't like having their tigers killed, their livestock killed by tigers. But for many of the people in the Far East, the Russians are hunters and trappers. So they're hunting the same game that the tigers are. They're working the same forests, following the same rivers. And yet there was little conflict historically. And there was an attitude among the Russians whom I met, and they said, if I don't touch her, the tiger, she won't touch me. And that all changed when the Russian border with China opened, and when Perestroika engineered the collapse of the communist social and economic structure. So throughout the 90s, you've had desperately poor Russians who are now able to trade freely with Chinese. And all of a sudden, the tiger, who was a kind of cohabitor of the forest, a fellow hunter, all of a sudden had this enormous price tag attached to it, because Chinese were willing to pay extraordinary sums, tens of thousands of dollars, for a dead tiger. And for Russians, who hadn't had a steady job in years at this point, by the mid-90s, who were feeding their families literally off the forest, the opportunity and the temptation that a tiger presented was enormous and irresistible. And that changed the whole dynamic. Basically, the opening of the border and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the economy that it, however clumsily, supported and maintained, completely destabilized decades of stability in the human-tiger relationship.
Why should the tiger be saved in its natural habitat?
The tiger is a canary in the coal mine. What the tiger is, you know, beyond this extraordinarily beautiful animal and keystone species and apex predator, what it also is, it's a symbol of health. It's a symbol of health for a much greater system. In other words, because it's an apex predator, everything needs to be intact underneath it for the tiger to be supported, because the tiger feeds on deer and boar. So for the deer and boar to survive in numbers to support tigers, there has to be enough nuts and grass and leaves for them to eat. There needs to be enough intact forest for them to hide and raise their young safely. So all these other systems need to be in place. The water, of course, needs to be clean and healthy. There needs to be control of hunting pressure by humans, just so there's enough game for the tigers to eat. So if all that's in place, what you have then is an intact and healthy ecosystem. And, you know, we have some, you know, examples of that all over the American West, up in Canada. You have places that support, you know, in some ways frightening numbers of mountain lions and grizzly bears. And that's a, I mean, that's a beautiful thing, because it means that the whole system is healthy and together. And we are connected to that and dependent on that health. And, you know, we're seeing all kinds of situations now where if you take all the trees away, if you take all the game away, you have massive erosion and the rivers are fouled and it's harder to grow crops. And so all these breakdowns impact us in very dramatic ways. And so in places where tigers survive and are allowed to survive, and that's really what it has come down to, we're allowing them to survive now. We have achieved such total dominance over other life forms that we're calling the shots now. And that's a kind of a frightening and a sobering responsibility. And the catch with the DNA question, of course you can save their DNA. There are thousands of tigers in captivity. But tigers are higher mammals, and you don't just have a tiger in a cage and then when you create a safe forest for it, let it loose. Tigers are taught by their mothers to how to behave, much as we are. It takes 2 to 3 years to teach a tiger to hunt properly. The cubs stay with their mothers even until they're almost full grown, practicing hunting and tracking scenarios. And if without that teaching, they're incompetent. And there are tiger farms in China where they're raising tigers like veal or chickens. And you watch these tigers when a live animal's thrown in there, and it's a horror show. They're completely incompetent. They don't know what to do with it. You know, they claw it and bite it and maul it, but there's none of the competence that you would have to have if they were going to survive in the wild. So it's really a grotesque situation.
And if you think about it, if you think the word tiger, my image instantly is a local zoo, a pacing animal, relentlessly pacing.
Yeah.
The sadness that you feel when you see that also, I think, is very important.
Yeah, and that's real, and you see that with wolves, too. And I remember going to the Bronx Zoo and watching this polar bear. And polar bears, like tigers and wolves, you know, are used to covering enormous territories. They're wanderers, they're explorers, they're big-time travelers. And watching this polar bear in this perfectly nice pen, but much too small, and it would walk forward 5 steps, stop with a sort of mechanical jerk and back up, start again, jerk, go forward. It had gone insane. It had gone mad in there. And it was a really chilling thing to see. And for tigers, too, you know, cats are extraordinarily adaptable. And if you're bred in captivity and used to only the cage, then what else are you going to know? But it's fundamentally unnatural. And there needs to be a place where tigers can do what tigers are meant to do. There needs to be a place for all of us to do what we were meant to do. And there are so many of us now, we need to figure out how we're going to share that space, to negotiate that balance. And it's really, I don't think we necessarily hired on to be in charge of the tiger's fate, but we are. It's that's how it's come down. And if the tiger goes extinct in the wild, which it's in serious danger of doing now, there are only 3,000 wild tigers left in all of Asia, perhaps 400 in Russia. A 97% drop from 100 years ago. You know, it's dire now, very, very dramatic. If the tiger is allowed to go extinct in the wild, it will be the largest predator to do so since the Pleistocene. So it'll be the first time in 10,000 years that we've lost a species of that size and importance from the planet.
Can you outline what is being done since we have this power? How are we using it?
It's very clear what needs to be done. I mean, here's the upside to this very distressing story is the fact that tigers are incredibly adaptable. They breed really well. If you stay out of their way and give them enough space, they will thrive and flourish and multiply. 2010 is the Chinese year of the tiger, but it is also considered to be the year of the tiger by conservation groups who are working increasingly cooperatively to protect what remains of tiger habitat and the species itself. So this is the year of the tiger. It's a pivotal year in the fate of this animal. What is generally agreed to be the greatest threat to tigers at this time is poaching. Poaching for the illegal trade in tiger skins and tiger parts, which are used for dubious medicines. The second greatest threat is habitat loss due to human expansion and encroachment, logging especially. So, but number one is poaching. And there, in Russia, there was an agency created called Inspection Tiger in the early 90s. And when those officers and wardens went into the forest, poaching was out of control. And when they entered the forest in 1994, it suppressed poaching in a dramatic way, so dramatic that it actually gave the tigers a chance to rebound. The training that these men are given is being funded now all across Asia. And it's demonstrably effective. It's measurably effective. And there are agencies now to whom your donations will make a dramatic difference. You can be assured that when you give money to these particular agencies, it's not going to be going to buy stamps for the next fundraising campaign. It's going to be going to buy gas for vehicles, to buy GPS and radio units so that these officers can stay in touch with each other, often impenetrable forests. So some of these agencies would be panthera.org, which is a pan-Asian agency, really, really excellent. Alan Rabinowitz is associated with it. George Schaller. These are luminaries of tiger research and conservation. Another one is the Wildlife Alliance. Their focus is in Southeast Asia, where the tiger situation is especially dire, but they also have a Russian component called Phoenix Fund, who is dedicating virtually all of its energies to anti-poaching efforts. Another one is 21stcenturytiger.org, and they guarantee, as Panthera does, that 100% of donations go directly to the field. And another one is Wildlife Conservation Society, is another terrific one. So these folks know the ground that they're working on, they know the issues, they know the people, they know the poachers, and they understand how desperate the circumstances are, and they also are deeply devoted to the preservation of the tiger, which is something that, you know, I think a lot of people can agree on but are confused about, well, how do I do it? How can I help? Well, contributing to these organizations, these charitable groups, will help, absolutely. What you could have taught me, I could have saved some face. They think that your early ending was all.
The Tiger, a true story of vengeance and survival, is not only a heart-stopping tale, it is a comprehensive exploration of the natural world. John Valiant describes the fate of the iconic tiger. As Valiant says, The tiger is a symbol we all understand.
At the beginning of the last century, it is estimated that there were more than 75,000 tigers living in Asia. Today, you would never know. Within the fragile envelope of a single human memory, 95% of those animals have been killed for sport, for beauty, for medicine, for money, for territory, and for revenge. Looking at distribution maps of tigers then and now is like looking at maps of European Jewry before and after World War II. You simply cannot believe your eyes. It is hard to imagine such a thing as possible, especially when you consider that tigers have accompanied our species throughout its entire history on the Asian continent and have been embraced for their physical, aesthetic, and iconic power.
John Valiant is also the author of the bestseller, The Golden Spruce, a true story of myth, madness, and greed. And that concludes our show. Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Constance Crompton. For more information, visit sqradio.org.
Support for Science Questions is also brought to you by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com. KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.